March 15th, 2025. Welcome to This Week in Waukesha, our new podcast series. I'm your host, Don Brown, coming to you from the office of former Alderman Don Paul Brown here in our beloved Banting Park home in Waukesha. I am joined by my faithful and expert producer, the mighty Max Martinson. And today's podcasts are actually, it's my first double feature, if you will, be the same guest for both podcasts. This is my good friend, Deanna Trouse from Truth in Common out of Washington, D.C. And Deanna, how are you?
I'm pretty good, Don. How are you?
Great, thanks, especially considering the situation. But before we dive into that, yes, this is St. Patrick's Day weekend, if you will. There's a big big game at noon today while this this podcast is being recorded. It's many of your beloved Badgers against my Michigan State Spartans at noon our time for in the Big Ten tournament semifinal. So I may look a little anxious, like I'm trying to rush these podcasts so I can catch the game on time. But also it's a week filled with even more uncertainty given what's going on in Washington, D.C. Some proposed federal cuts include PBS and NPR are without a doubt our most neutral or objective sources of news in media. Some other alarming news, I understand from the Maggie Dawn show that information our State Department has gathered about Russians abducting Ukrainian children during that war, that the Trump administration has terminated the submission of that information over to European authorities, if you will, for lack of a better term. But in addition to St. Patrick's Day weekend, it's also today's the Ides of March, March 15th. And for those of you who don't know your Roman history, there was a soothsayer, one who could see the future, who had warned Emperor Julius Caesar to beware of the Ides of March. And he kind of, I guess he didn't pay close enough attention because it was around this time that he was assassinated by senators, including his closest friend and confidant, Brutus. So anyway, it's rather timely giving our discussions. Deanna was a guest on my radio show last fall. Her nonprofit, Truth in Common, provides workshop information and related resources to teach everyday people like you and me how to identify misinformation, how to address it, how to have meaningful dialogues with those of you who are very politically opposed to your view, your point of view, and how can we regain civility, especially at the most local level. So, but Deanna's also a Washington, D.C. resident, and she's witnessing firsthand the impact of these federal cuts. Many of her neighbors are federal employees, as one can imagine, and a very scary time for her at the local level, which I'm grateful to give her this opportunity to share that with us. And then in the second part of this podcast, we're also going to talk about kind of the big national high profile impacts and how this misinformation continues. But in the second part, we're going to talk about how we can deal with this locally, what we can do to salvage our small D Democratic, small R Republican way of government, our way of life, and whatever we can do to preserve that to the best of our ability. And so, Deanna, the floor is yours. I'll let you kind of give an opening statement, if you will, and then I have a few questions for you. So go ahead.
Sure. Excellent. Thanks so much, Don. It really is notable that it's the Ides of March today. Interestingly, as you were kind of going through the history there, which I always love and commend you for your command of history and just details of all kinds. I thought about the fact that I've been pretty focused on April 15th because as we see, the IRS is not free of the sort of hatchet job that they're taking to the federal government. And I keep thinking, you know, as someone who runs several, a nonprofit, a small, even a consulting operation, our family taxes, thinking, you know, I keep saying, get the taxes in because we may not have people to process them soon. And then I recognize that I've been focused on that 15th and that today is also kind of a notable day as well. So, so thanks so much for inviting me to tell the story of what's happening here in DC. Obviously, we are affected in a dual way on the federal level, given that the seat of government, the US government, is here. Many of our, as you mentioned, neighbors work for federal agencies, and many of the leadership of those federal agencies are housed here, working in, living and working in either Washington, DC, Northern Virginia, or Maryland. So, you know, to make, to be honest, it's not, you know, people think that there's sort of an, and there's so many stats flying around right now, it's almost impossible to kind of track what's, because things are happening so quickly. But the stats are this, that 20% of the entire federal workforce, which you will see either 2 or 1 million people comprise, that workforce is comprised of either 2 or 1 million, 3 million people, depending on what sources you check. But in the millions, 20% of that entire federal workforce is here in the district, Maryland or Virginia. In Washington, DC specifically, we're a community of 700,000 people. 13% of our workforce are federal workers. So we have a lot of federal workers, but there's other states, we're not a state, as we'll talk about, but there's other states that have even more significant numbers of federal employees. But needless to say that it affects our economy greatly when people lose their jobs at federal agencies. It affects our housing prices. It affects, you know, pretty much everything here. But really what can resonate for people are the local stories. For example, I spoke with someone yesterday who is in very similar line of work, someone who used to work for USAID as a contractor and delivered actual media literacy trainings, just like we do at Truth and Comment, around the world, following an evidence-based curriculum, working in Ukraine and many other countries, helping people navigate digital spaces, avoid falsehoods. And he talked about, he's got small kids, he lost his job, but equally impactful is the way in this, which this is going down. You know, it's incredibly toxic to have, he described a lack of information, confusing information, you know, being let go without any notice. You know, that can, obviously you have to still pay your bills, regardless you have time to make a plan. And then just the trauma of sort of being let go overnight, and the effects on family, explaining to children as well. So he described that toxicity, and that's happening in spades here, but also around the country. I had another friend who's pretty high up at the FDA who was worried about being subjected to personal attacks and trolling on social media, just because she has a high level job at the FDA. I mean, that these dynamics, this is what I sort of term inhumane leadership, to let people go in this manner. It's not okay. But my personal opinion is that it's not okay. Anyone here would say that the federal government is certainly not perfect, that there's bloating, that there's no doubt waste. I worked with captains of industry like Bob Galvin and Paul O'Neill, who were part of the Six Sigma movement, who said, yes, eliminating waste from any system is an honorable and needed thing to do. They were also people first leaders. They would empower employees to be on board with these, with things like eliminating waste, give them the project, not just cut people overnight. I can't tell you how opposite the approaches were that they described to me versus what's really happening. Another friend of mine was furloughed because she had simply the word social justice in her job description, and she worked for the EPA and now has been reinstated.
What were the reasons for the reinstatement? Do you know?
Well, I think what we're seeing is big moves that get a lot of PR value and then walking back certain things. So she did make a fuss and had the union behind her. She had just joined. And so maybe that was part of it. But a lot of it is, you know, there's other programs that they cut and people were reinstated without, you know, very quickly. So it's like, make the big dramatic cut. It plays well on social media. And then we may have to walk it back, but that messaging isn't going to travel the same way that the initial does.
This is a good lead into my first question, Deanne. It's kind of a eureka moment this morning as I was listening to a TikTok from Kristen Bry, formerly of Civic Media, now with TMJ News Radio, I believe. Really great news journalist. And she had mentioned that all of these big news items, like trying to annex Greenland and Canada, and even the more direct hit ones like these proposed layoffs, could they be a red herring to distract us from everything that's going on behind the scenes for the Trump administration to take even further control? And some of the language in her reporting, it mentioned that they're basically grooming the next two generations of people to rule this new technocracy or this new oligarchy, which many of us fear. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with the latter wholeheartedly. I don't think that someone would take steps this drastic if they weren't pretty sure that they were going to be able to hold on to power for some time to come. Mm-hmm. In terms of the first comment, as cover, I think that's, I look at it slightly differently, but it's a similar, it's sort of a similar outcome, right? Where the current administration and those that were able to regain power in November or gain power are excellent at fueling the social media machine and providing information and messaging that is so dramatic and sensational that the algorithms love it. It's algorithm food. Yeah. And so that is the information that spreads very widely. They're able to tie up the news cycle and all of our attention pretty much constantly. And yes, that could be cover for what's going on behind the scenes, for sure. That's one way to look at it. And another way is to just notice that a lot of this is public relations, in a sense. Like, that's kind of a traditional term to phrase it. Now we're in a social media world. But if you think about some of the executive orders, you know, those that nothing much came from, I almost started looking at them as almost like a press release. Yeah. Something to get news and seem very like a very dramatic step. Uh-huh. That, you know, may or may not even have led to any real action. And then if you think about more, you know, some of the most dramatic moments, like, for example, flying migrants to Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah.
There was video recorded of that. That's a very visual opportunity. There was video recorded of that. Someone even referred to it as sort of like these ASMR videos of migrants getting off the plane. And then they were returned twice, not once, but twice. Wow. To the tune, and it all cost taxpayers $16 million.
Wow.
So you got to ask why that was done. Were they just didn't realize that's not an appropriate or legal thing to do?
Sure.
Or was it simply for, you know, television's sake? I honestly think of the Hunger Games a lot, you know, where everything was for TV.
Yes. And so, because I know you've been following this closely and you shared some metrics with me on it that, and you mentioned algorithms. What is there a way to simplify the way that the media or those, I guess, MAGA or those whatever nefarious forces behind them, the way that they're manipulating the media through social, particularly through social media outlets? How is that all working? And what should we be aware of? Because everything I'm getting on my social media outlets warns of, again, potential takeover, dictatorship, oligarchy, so many things that are traitorous to our and threaten our American way of life. And so, but there's a significant population, a large enough population of people out there getting different kind of reporting that says like, hey, we're winning. Like, what's going on?
Right.
And I shouldn't laugh. This is serious.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the key thing to know is that if you think about the sum total of the information you take in on a daily basis, whether it's through, you know, traditional mainstream media or your social media feeds, whatever, we all are kind of, most people are multi-channel consumers now of information.
Yeah.
Now, you may be somebody who, you know, gravitates more to mainstream, or you might be someone who gravitates more to social. Yeah. But the point is that even the feeds that you and I, the information flows that come into my world and yours are different. Mm-hmm. The information flows that come into my world and someone who has very different viewpoints from mine are dramatically different, if not, and there's less and less crossover, such that we're almost operating in different environments altogether.
Right.
So that is so important to understand, and people kind of downplay that. And it is pretty much everything, because how do you form your viewpoints? Through the information you see. How do you form your opinion on these things? Yeah. If you're consuming, for example, a ton of information, a ton of opinion, random people on YouTube, whatever, then you're going to adopt those opinions. You probably aren't doing the research to, you know, fact check yourself. Etc. So it's just important to know that those feeds are so different. And honestly, you know, I will not, we have to kind of make sure we're not using the media in a generalizing sense to the, in any kind of disparaging way, because honestly, fact-based journalism is the flow, right? Experts, legit experts in fact-based journalism and fact checkers are pretty much what we have to be able to trust to understand what's going on. So all of us being intentional and following those is really important.
Okay. And now, shifting gears, you know, with the 5 minutes we have left in this first podcast towards, I guess, the power structure, what are the remaining recourses that we have, our federal government has for combating this? I know there was a federal court judge in New York City that had put a kibosh on some Trump administration cuts. I forget which department it was for, but he'd called the thing a sham. And so, you know, will that hold, or will a higher court then, or will it go all the way to the Supreme Court and then get reversed?
There's such a volume of lawsuits that, and they are working, so to speak, to expose the illegality of a lot of these moves. You can't just cancel the Department of Education. It was established through, you know, legislation from Congress. Like that, that's
you needed Congress to,
And that's something each of us can really focus on, is where are the legalities here and where are the illegalities? Where is the Constitution being blatantly, you know, upended? I just saw someone from Public Citizen. This is such a DC moment. Like, I was out there watching a half marathon go by, and she works for Public Citizen, and they're suing the about a lot of these moves, suing the administration on a lot of these moves. Okay. And she said, she's a fundraiser, and said that a lot of resources are coming in to do that. So feel confident about that.
With these lawsuits in place, does that not legally put these moves on hold until they're settled in court?
I don't think that's on hold is really an accurate there doesn't seem to be, I mean, they're skirting Congress pretty much every day. So I don't think those norms are being followed.
Okay.
So sometimes yes, perhaps. And the reinstatements are often because of court order, but there's a lot that is happening.
And I did see some movements within the last maybe week and a half of some Republican legislators that are speaking out, that are sharing our concern, principled conservatives, you could say, that and even what MAG is proposing, tariffs and the like, are very contrary to conservative economic principles. Is that
completely?
Are we seeing some tangible progress there, or is this smoke and mirrors? Or will these people eventually be?
For example, there's a local story. I mean, I won't go into the structure of the Washington D.C. government, but the continuing resolution threatened our budget. I don't know if you saw that.
$1 million. Yeah, I saw your post on it as well.
I've been posting on Facebook. Anyway, Susan Collins of Maine, a Republican, put the bill on the table in the Senate to say, we're not taking D.C. taxpayers' dollars for let them spend their own money. And that passed in a bipartisan way. It still has to pass the House, which is another matter.
Right.
So there are bipartisan moments, and there are bright spots in terms of legal actions prevailing.
Sure. So there's some encouragement there.
Yes. So that was a real bright spot, just not just for us, but everybody should take hope in that. There are some level-headed moments for sure.
Well, great. And then is there, I guess, strategic partnerships we could form, like Truth in Common, with other NGOs and other organizations, and maybe even whatever political action committees are there, to kind of build more of a stronger, a stronger opposition? Or force, if you will.
Well, I think that, you know, we're obviously continuing to do workshops through public libraries. We do professional development with folks that are kind of on the front lines of sorting through mis and disinformation with their constituents, whatever. So certainly that work's continuing. There are others doing related work, whatever. I think that there is tons of pro-democracy action going on right now. As I mentioned, a lot of that's going to be behind the scenes because everyone's now open to attack. So people have to be patient and really understand that that work is happening. Alliances are forming.
Okay. How are we doing on time, Max? Okay, we have to wind down this first podcast, but stick around for podcast two with Deanna Trouse of Truth in Common. And thank you for joining us so far. And then the next one, we're going to take a real local dive into what we can do in our own communities and neighborhoods. Excellent. Stick around. This Week in Waukesha continues.
Thanks, y'all.